Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 244, being recorded on August 13th of the year 2000. It's entitled Line of Succession, subtitled Restoring Dignity to the Office of the Presidency. And by the way, that's an extremely sarcastic title, and it refers to the Georges Bush, among others. In fact, it refers to several people. It refers to the Georges Bush, Gerald Ford, and, by extension, Richard Nixon, even Earl Warren. Many of these people could be referred to as, quote, vice, unquote, presidents, in that they were president or vice president and got to where they got to because of vice, at least in part. I find it very ironic that one of the campaign issues being made by the Republicans and George Walker Bush is the notion that they are somehow going to restore dignity to the office of the presidency. That is extremely ironic. And I think it'll be worthwhile to take a look at the candidacy of George Herbert Walker, because George Herbert Walker Bush, when he was running on his own in 1988, basically presented himself as a continuation of the administration of Ronald Reagan, and yet there are some very interesting connections between George Herbert Walker Bush and the shooting attempt, and not the shooting attempt, but the shooting of Ronald Reagan, the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life. And we're also going to take a look in the second half of the program at connections between the, quote, vice, unquote, presidents, ranging from George Herbert Walker Bush, who at the time was an oil man, to Gerald Ford, who was House Minority Leader, later a vice president, later president, Richard Nixon. We're going to take a look at Watergate, and we're going to take a look at the assassination of President Kennedy, and we're also going to take a look at Dick Cheney, currently the vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket. I don't think it is unfair to evaluate George Walker Bush in terms of his father and his father's administration. The following is from the New York Times of Friday, July 21st of the year 2000. It's an op-ed column by David Brooks, a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. It's headline, New Party Mission, Old Party Hands, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. If the Bushes win, they can cancel the White House orientation because everybody will have already worked there. The foreign policy team is like a Desert Storm reunion tour. Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, and Robert Zoellick all worked for President George Bush. Skipping down. On the domestic side are prominent Bush administration alumni like Lawrence Lindsay, Joseph Bolton, and Michael Boskin. So bear in mind the senior George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and we're going to listen to an archive show, specifically an excerpt of an archive show, that archive show being George Bush and the Shooting of Ronald Reagan, Miscellaneous Archive Show M20. It was recorded on July 10th. Of 1988. Now, bear in mind that the George Bush referred to here as a candidate for president is George Herbert Walker Bush, and we're going to take a look at how he helped to restore dignity to the office of the presidency with regard to Ronald Reagan, the man whose mantle he wound up assuming. This, again, is excerpted from a Miscellaneous Archive Show M20, George Bush and the Shooting of Ronald Reagan, from July 10th of 1988. Tonight, and for archival purposes, we're going to take a look at some of the information. Again, this is just some of the information concerning the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. This by way of assessing George Bush as a presidential candidate. Reading now from some of the articles that emerged in the popular press immediately after the shooting of President Reagan, which took place on March 30th of 1981. That was a Monday. Now, reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, March 31st of 1981. This is a story called John Hinckley, Profile of a Typical Guy. It's by Phil Bronstein of the Examiner, Dateline, Denver, Colorado. Up top, as a by way of a subhead, there's a quote from an American Nazi Party official. He wanted to shoot people and blow things up. We were not sufficiently militant for him. That quoting Nazi Party officials. Skipping down into the article, and moving to the back page, this from page A14, San Francisco Examiner 33181, we find the following. That's John Hinckley, his father, J.W. Jack Hinckley, president of a Denver oil exploration firm, remember the oil connection here, told Religious Associates some months ago that his son had long-standing psychological problems. The senior Hinckley told staff members of World Vision,
a Southern California Christian group in which he was involved, that he felt, quote, great anxiety, unquote, over his son, who had, quote, problems for a long time, unquote. Remember the World Vision connection, we're coming back to it. An unidentified family friend told the Dallas Morning News, quote, John was simply what you would call their loner. They only talked about him in the way parents would when they hoped their individualist would come around and become one of the gang, unquote. Well, apparently he did indeed try to become one of the gang, witness the following paragraph. In Chicago, the president-elect of the National Socialist Party of America, Michael C. Allen, said Hinckley was expelled from the neo-Nazi party in November of 1979 because he, quote, wanted to shoot people and blow things up, unquote. The party official described Hinckley as a, quote, nut, unquote. He said they first met at a neo-Nazi march in St. Louis on March 12, 1978. A party leader said Hinckley left because, quote, he felt that we were not sufficiently militant for him, unquote. Harold Covington, president of the neo-Nazi group, said, quote, he wanted us to go out and commit unlawful acts. We sort of carried on a debate about it, unquote. Skipping down in the article. On October 9, 1980, Hinckley was arrested trying to board a plane at the Nashville airport. He was carrying a .38 caliber revolver, two .22 caliber revolvers, and 50 rounds of ammunition. The guns were found as Hinckley's luggage passed through an X-ray scanner at a boarding checkpoint as Hinckley was preparing to board an American Airlines flight to New York. Hinckley was freed after he posted a $62.50 bond. The guns and ammunition were confiscated. And now as to what he may have been doing at the Nashville airport, regard the following paragraph. Former President Jimmy Carter was campaigning at Nashville's Grand Ole Opry that day, and 2 days earlier, Reagan had canceled a campaign stop in Memphis. The .22 caliber gun Hinckley allegedly used to shoot Reagan and three others yesterday was purchased at Rocky's Pawn Shop in Dallas on October 13th, according to the FBI. It is one of a string of pawn shops on the same street on which President John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. One wonders how deep some of these coincidences go. Hinckley, incidentally, was a native of Dallas, Texas. Witness the following paragraph. Hinckley is skipping down again in the same article. Hinckley was born in Ardmore, Oklahoma, on May 29, 1955, according to hospital records. You know, I just realized that is John F. Kennedy's birthday as well. Also, incidentally, May Brussels. 2 years later, he moved with his family to a plush, two-story brick house with a swimming pool in the exclusive Dallas, Texas suburb of Highland Park. The family lived there until 1974, when it moved to Evergreen. That's Evergreen, Colorado. So, interestingly enough here, John Hinckley Sr.'s connections with World Vision are to be remembered. John Hinckley Sr.'s connections with the National Socialist Party of America are to be remembered here. The fact that members of that party suspected he was a federal agent should be remembered. And his curiously light treatment when he was hanging around the Nashville airport with all kinds of guns and ammunition, right about the time not only Jimmy Carter but Ronald Reagan were due in there. Interesting article here also in the same issue of the San Francisco Examiner. It's kind of ironic to evaluate this in light of that last information. How did he get so close? Agents want to find out. Dateline Washington Examiner News Services. How could it happen that in the nation's capital, a mile from the White House, a gunman stationed himself in the midst of a group of reporters and from 10 feet fired 6 shots at the President of the United States? Well, again, I think perhaps the following information, again repeating from the previous story. On October 9, 1980, Hinckley was arrested while trying to board a plane at the Nashville airport. He was carrying a .38 caliber revolver, two .22 caliber revolvers, and 50 rounds of ammunition. The guns were found, etc., etc. So somebody apparently was willing to let Hinckley go with a little more than a slap on the wrist, despite the fact that he appeared to be a pretty dangerous fellow. If we can believe the Nazi party officials, a little too extreme even for them, and remember they suspected of him of being a federal agent. More on the shooting of President Reagan. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of the following day, Wednesday, April 1st of 1981. This is from a story from page one. It's called A Bizarre Motive for Shooting Reagan. It deals with the apparent cover story, which was floated to hide what I believe were the real political motives behind the Reagan shooting. Only occasionally, as in his conversations with the Lubbock maintenance man, were aspects of his life and his problems remembered. It was in Texas that Hinckley first met members of the National Socialist Party of America, who took him with them on an automobile journey in March of 78 to St. Louis, where he participated in an NSPA march to commemorate the birthday of George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party. He seemed committed to our cause. He was bright, a little understated, said Michael C. Allen, acting director of the group recalling the St. Louis March. He wore uniforms like the rest of us. He was a stormtrooper. Black boots, the swastika, khakis, and the black helmet. But he was too militant. He wanted to destroy our enemies, blacks, Jews, and communists. It got to the point, said party stormtrooper John Gaynor, that we suspected him of being a federal agent. He was just too far out. He wanted to destroy people. The Nazis themselves, I would say, of course, have also been known to want to destroy people, at least in the opinions of many here. But it's interesting that this particular Nazi group was one of the groups that goes directly back to George Lincoln Rockwell. Recall that George Lincoln Rockwell's Arlington, Virginia address and phone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. Not that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. There is conclusive evidence that he didn't even fire a gun, let alone kill somebody. However, it's worth taking note of all of these pieces of evidence in order to determine the nature of the forces who were handling Oswald and creating the cover story, which has now come down to us in history, namely Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, shot President Kennedy, and then as to why pick one from column A and one from column B. He wanted publicity, he couldn't get enough sex, etc., etc., or, of course, he was a commie. He wasn't a commie, of course, we know now. He was a CIA agent. Of the connections between the Hinckley family and the Bush family, arguably the most important connections here, reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, April 1st of 1981. This is a UPI story, Dateline Houston, and headlined, Suspect's Brother Knows Bush's Son. The brother of John W. Hinckley, Jr., the man accused of shooting President Reagan, was to have been a dinner guest last night at the home of Vice President George Bush's son, Neil, the Houston Post said in a copyright story yesterday. Neil Bush, who lives in Denver, said Monday his family knew the Hinckley family because they'd made large contributions to the vice president's primary campaign. He said he had once met Scott Hinckley but could not recall meeting his younger brother, who was accused of shooting Reagan and three other men Monday. Bush's wife, Sharon, said the dinner had been canceled. I would interrupt. I don't bet that it wasn't. Scott Hinckley is vice president of his father's Denver-based oil firm, Vanderbilt Energy Company. Again, repeating this, Scott Hinckley is vice president of his father's Denver-based oil firm, Vanderbilt Energy Corporation. He could not be reached for comment. Bush, who works as a land lawyer for Standard Oil Company of Indiana, said he could not recall meeting the subject. Sharon Bush said she did not know the subject. Quote, here quoting Sharon Bush, they, the Hinckleys, are a nice family and have given a lot of money to the Bush campaign, she said. I understand he, John Hinckley, was just the renegade brother in the family. They must feel awful. Well, it's interesting here that, according to this article, the Hinckley family were prominent backers of Vice President George Bush's primary campaign. And not only that, but they were apparent business and social contacts between them. Interesting here, too, that, of course, the Bushes were involved in independent oil companies on the Gulf Coast, Zapata Oil being the cover firm, apparently, if we can believe the article in the Nation magazine. And here, Vanderbilt Energy, another independent oil company, was the main business interest of the Hinckley family. And in fact, the Hinckley's Vanderbilt Energy was being investigated, or was the object of a proposed federal investigation at this time. And again, the proposed business deal here, and the dinner, which was to discuss possible business deal, is very, very interesting here. When one studies this country's political assassinations, it's remarkable how very quickly and easily one gets to connections to the obvious people that would benefit from a given political assassination. For example, the assassination of John Kennedy, we have Richard Nixon in Dallas on November 22, 1963, flying out right about the time Kennedy is getting killed and then lying about it to the FBI 2 months later. Lyndon Baines Johnson himself, LBJ, the vice president, had all kinds of obvious connections to the assassination itself, and I think it speaks extremely poorly for the political instincts and dedication of the American people that the type of research that myself and others in the field do continues to be dismissed as conspiracy theory. I think if people saw one of these assassinations done up as a plot on, say, Columbo or The Equalizer or some television crime melodrama, people would get bored and they'd probably turn it off after 10 minutes and get some ginger ale or something because they'd know that they'd know the ending of the plot. At any rate, again, although we cannot say for sure, certainly I think a possible motive here and a milieu which stood to benefit concretely from the death of Ronald Reagan is at least pointed to by some of the pieces of information in these stories. More on the connection between the Bush family and the Hinckley family. Of course, don't forget that George Bush was former director of the CIA and had something happen to Ronald Reagan, George Bush would have become the most powerful man in the United States. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News from Wednesday, April 1st of 1981, this is another story continued from the front page, and it's skipping down in the story. Again, I don't have the front page with me here, but skipping down in the story, and on page 24A of the Mercury, 4181, we find the following at the top of the page under the heading Reagan Shooting Suspect Baird Plan in Love Letter. Vice President George Bush acknowledged Tuesday that his son, Neil, is a casual acquaintance of Hinckley's elder brother, Scott, 28. The two were to have dined together at Neil Bush's Denver home Tuesday evening. Scott Hinckley is dating a friend of Neil Bush's wife. So again, these two families are not strangers, and recall also, perhaps more significantly, that they are political allies. Recalling now John W. Hinckley Sr.'s connections with an organization called World Vision, we're now going to take a look at some information concerning World Vision. The following, the research credit for the following articles goes to Sarah Diamond. This is from the National Catholic Reporter of April 23rd, 1982. It's by Adrienne Pennick, P-E-N-N-I-N-K, and Steve Askin, A-S-K-I-N. Its headline, Refugees Tell of Abuses at Hands of Agency. This is about World Vision and its apparent links, at least to a certain extent, to the CIA. The two Salvadorians arrived in Limones No. 2 refugee camp one evening last May. The camp coordinator reported their names to local authorities. The next day, Honduran soldiers demanded to see the refugees and took them away in a jeep. 2 days later, the refugees' lifeless bodies were found by the Lempa River, which forms the border between Honduras and El Salvador. According to World Vision, the Evangelical Protestant Relief and Mission Agency responsible for supervising the camp, the May incident was a horrible accident. To workers with other agencies serving refugees, both Protestant and Catholic, it was proof that their worst fears were justified, that World Vision was collaborating with Honduran and Salvadorian security forces against the refugees it was supposed to serve. Skipping down. Last year, several aid groups reported that they had stopped registering refugees with the government because they suspected names were being handed over to the death squads. World Vision continued to supply names. The behavior of World Vision staff members convinced many refugees that they were working with Honduran or Salvadorian security forces. Dozens of former residents of a World Vision-supervised camp in the Guarita region spoke of World Vision workers who appeared to be cooperating with security forces or who threatened reprisals against those who refused to convert. Members of one refugee family said World Vision workers told them, quote, "You will not receive food because you don't believe in our religion," unquote. Others told of World Vision workers who openly discussed their backgrounds in the Guatemalan secret police and Anastasio Somoza's Nicaraguan National Guard. The charges against World Vision were most starkly detailed in a memorandum prepared last June by the Honduran office of another international humanitarian group obtained through U.S. sources. Quote, "All the information I was given can be verified," the author wrote, "but it was agreed that to denounce World Vision locally would be dangerous not only for the refugees but for all the organizations working with them," unquote. The three-page memo was compiled from reports by several aid groups. Their names have been withheld to protect workers still in Honduras. Skipping down on the story, critics such as Father Earl Gallagher, U.S. priest who worked with refugees in the Guarita region, say World Vision workers repeatedly used food to pressure refugees to attend Protestant churches. Quote, "If they don't accept, they are warned that their food is going to be cut and that they will be handed over to the military authorities who in turn will hand them over to Salvadorian authorities, which means instant death," Gallagher said. "We have had many instances of that." He remembered an incident last June 26th when a World Vision representative visited a home near Guarita where 15 Salvadorians were living. According to Gallagher, the refugees were told, quote, "You accept this sect or I'm going to cut your food. If you don't, we are going to hand you over to the Salvadorians," unquote. Other refugee workers told similar stories but asked not to be identified by name. And again, following credit for the following story also goes to Sarah Diamond. This from Christian Century magazine, specifically Christian Century from July 4th through July 11th from 1979. This is an article called World Vision Go Home, or headlined World Vision Go Home, skipping down into the story. It was during the Vietnam War that many of World Vision's inadequacies began to emerge. Instead of being a nonpartisan humanitarian operation, it expressed clear anti-communist sentiments and was openly supportive of American military participation. Indeed, at least 75% of its Cambodian operation was funded by USAID. American military trucks and helicopters were always available for World Vision programs, and the CIA used information obtained by the group's field workers as part of its normal intelligence function. As South Vietnam's government began to topple in 1975, World Vision became one of the many aid organizations to leave. In Laos, the new government was more tolerant of some of the aid programs, but the Minister of Religious Affairs was openly critical of missionary groups in both Vietnam and Laos, which had let themselves be used as agents for the CIA. He claimed that, quote, the activities of World Vision, an American-based aid operation, had antagonized the people so much that there were popular demonstrations and the decision had to be made at cabinet level to have them expelled from the country. In the following years, World Vision tried hard to win credibility in several other Asian nations, but its ideological blind spots have created difficulties. So it appears that World Vision, at least in certain areas, has been used as a front organization by elements of the U.S. intelligence community and national security establishment. Again, that makes the John Hinckley Sr. connection to World Vision all the more interesting in light of not only the Hinckley connections to the George Bush primary campaign, the social and business connections, or burgeoning business connections, between the Hinckley and Bush family. Scott Hinckley and Neil Bush were going to discuss a possible business deal. It also makes George Bush's connections to the CIA, his possible connections in 1963, according to FBI reports, or his connections to the agency in 63, according to FBI reports, possible involvement in the aftermath of the assassination of John Kennedy, or perhaps the actual assassination of John Kennedy. And it also raises interesting questions concerning George Bush's tenure as CIA director. Interestingly enough, a prominent intelligence-linked attorney took the Hinckley case, or his law firm took the Hinckley case. Reading from the San Francisco Examiner from Wednesday, April 1st of 1981, in an article begun on the front page, Hinckley's Love Letter to Teenage Movie Star, we find the following story continued on page A12 of that issue. Hinckley, meanwhile, retained the firm of millionaire Washington defense attorney Edward Bennett Williams, a former treasurer of the Democratic National Committee and owner of the Baltimore Orioles baseball team. A member of the firm confirmed the two lawyers spent more than 2 hours yesterday interviewing Hinckley in the prison at the U.S. Marine Base at Quantico, Virginia. Well, Edward Bennett Williams is a very prominent attorney who's handled a lot of intelligence-related cases. He was the attorney for, among others, former CIA Director Richard Helms, and in his case where he was convicted of lying to Congress. He also has represented Robert Vesco, a man with more connections than a switchboard. He has also represented, in the past, John Connolly. He has also represented Jimmy Hoffa and a whole host of other people. The law firm of Edward Bennett Williams has been close to all kinds of people in the intelligence community, very close to the Graham family of the Washington Post and others. In fact, they handled the execution of Philip Graham's estate. So the Hinckley law firm, or the Williams law firm being called in on this case, is very, very significant here in my estimation. It's interesting, too, to see the kind of treatment that Hinckley's Nazi connections got after the Edward Bennett Williams law firm was engaged on their behalf. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, May 18th of 1982, more than a year later, the Nazi connections are receiving the following kind of play. This in an article by Stuart Taylor, Jr. of the New York Times, Dateline, Washington, skipping down. Hinckley, a white man who flirted with the American Nazi Party and imagined himself the leader of a racist, extreme right-wing political organization, is being tried before a black federal judge in a jury of 11 blacks and one white. But Hinckley's lawyers have not complained that his rights to a fair trial will be jeopardized by the racial makeup of the jury, and trial lawyers here say they do not believe either the prosecution or the defense will gain any particular advantage from it. Skipping down, Dr. William T. Carpenter, Jr., the first defense psychiatrist to testify as an expert witness, said that by 1979 Hinckley idolized Hitler and was writing elaborate manifestos casting himself as head of an imaginary front, of an imaginary organization called the American Front, unquote, which would elevate, quote, white Protestants above blacks in the New York-Hollywood media axis of Jewish domination. Well, apparently Hinckley's Nazi connections were more than imaginary, whether he was in fact the head of his own organization or whether that was sort of a cover. Certainly the right-wing Nazi and possibly intelligence connections of John Hinckley and his family did not receive the play they should have. And again, I think this by way of evaluating some of George Bush's background. It's also, again, very interesting that we see George Bush's name now cropping up in connection with the Kennedy assassination.
That excerpted from Miscellaneous Archive Show M20 from July 10th of 1988. Now, jumping back to August 13th of the year 2000, when George W., the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, is going to, quote, restore dignity to the office of the presidency, unquote. He, by the way, has an interesting vice presidential selection. One of his father's close cabinet advisors or appointments. New York Times of Wednesday, July 26th of the year 2000, chronicles the possible role, the probable role, of George Herbert Walker Bush in selecting his son's vice presidential candidate. This is an article by Allison Mitchell, Dateline Austin, Texas, headlined, "The Process, Cheney as the Finalist, Bush Did the Screening." And skipping down, we read, "There are signs that Mr. Bush's father was taking an interest in the vice presidential search, and a specific interest in Mr. Cheney." Ms. Hughes, a spokesperson for Bush, Bush Jr., said Ms. Hughes today described the former president's role as, quote, "that of a loving father," unquote, ready to lend an ear to his son. Asked if the former president supported Mr. Cheney above all candidates, she said she was, quote, "sure he spoke highly of several of them," unquote. I would also note that Dick Cheney is an official with Halliburton Oil. We're going to come back to this in the second half of the program, Wall Street Journal of July 26th of the year 2000. This is an article by Alexei Barrionuevo, headlined, "Cheney Plied Political Savvy to Lubricate Oil Firms' Deals." Subtitled, "Bush Running Mate Grew Halliburton Using Discipline and Diplomacy He Honed in D.C. A couple of the interesting connections of Halliburton Oil. February of 1998, Halliburton agrees to buy Dresser Industries for $7.7 billion in stock. Dresser Industries was George Herbert Walker Bush's first employer when he graduated from Yale. And skipping down, February of 1999, Halliburton's Brown & Root Services Construction Unit wins a contract in Yugoslavia. And Brown & Root was part of a milieu along with Dresser Industries that we looked at in RFA 37 in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. More about Dick Cheney, and we're going to come back to him, and it appears that his father helped to select the son's vice presidential candidate. This from the New York Times of Tuesday, July 25th of the year 2000, also by Allison Mitchell, and also about Dick Cheney. It's headlined, "Bush reported set to name Cheney as partner on ticket." And skipping down, of Dick Cheney, "By age 34, Mr. Cheney was already White House Chief of Staff, helping President Gerald Ford with the difficult transition after the Watergate scandal that drove President Richard M. Nixon from office." So Dick Cheney was Gerald Ford's White House Chief of Staff when he succeeded another, quote, vice, unquote, president, Richard Nixon. And the New York Times of Saturday, August 12th of the year 2000, has an op-ed column by Theodore Sorensen, a former writer speechwriter for President Kennedy. "The torch didn't pass to George W. Bush." Skipping down, this reads, "Some in George W. Bush's camp say this race is Kennedy-Nixon all over again, but with Governor Bush as the fresh face challenging the two-term vice president. Mr. Bush even included footage of Kennedy in the video that preceded his nomination speech. This is grotesque, and just how grotesque we will discuss in the second half of For the Record program number 244, Line of Succession, Restoring Dignity to the Office of the Presidency." Spitfire is the tape duplication service that stocks all of the tapes that I've alluded to, including Miscellaneous Archive Show M20. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And you can visit their website at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire, and it's equipped with real audio. That concludes For the Record program 244. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.